Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Save the Planet. Why not? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming back to another episode. It's been a two-week hiatus here, but me and Timo are so excited to be back in the studio, aka our kitchen, drinking wine, and talking to you about climate change. Today's theme is going to be about the media. So the media has a very instrumental role. They are obviously the ones that report on the climate crisis. They're the main source of information for people. So it's very good to critique their practices and make sure that they're following through with accurately reporting this planetary emergency. Unfortunately, it does not seem to be that case.
Indeed.
So before we get into all of the issues with the media, including the corporate landscape of the media and alternative sources of media, we're going to just dive into the wine here. And
Yes. So we've got a rather unconventional wine this week, which I would never usually have picked. But in this case, it sort of fits with the topic of the media and with some of the issues it represents. So that'll soon become very clear when I reveal that we've actually bought boxed wine this week.
Boxed wine. I saved the planet.
Shock
wine
horror.
First.
Shock horror, Silver Bay Point, red, soft and fruity, boxed wine. So for those of you who've never heard of the concepts of storing wine in a box, it comes in this cardboard box, and once you open it, you realize that there's actually this aluminium sack with a, with a little tap on it, and that's what contains the wine, so you've got to just hold the sack and then pour it out. So in and of itself, I guess it could still contain some tasty wine, but it's not very promising because obviously what we're used to is a glass bottle holding the wine, and that's the conventional type.
Yes.
So I guess the idea behind choosing this wine for tonight's episode was that often we don't know what we're dealing with when it comes to the news. We don't know which ones to trust, which news sources to trust. We don't know where our information is coming from, and we've often got to take the news's word for it, that the information they're providing is accurate and is reliable.
Indeed.
So I guess we've made a similar leap of faith with this boxed wine by kind of hoping that its contents will live up to its exciting and unusual promise. So well, should we have a little taste of this?
Go on. Cheers.
Oh, it definitely does not live up to its promise.
I mean, it's quite literally fruit juice.
It is the wine equivalent of fake news.
Of climate denial.
It's sickening.
It's climate denial times fake news. It's a combination of those two horrendous things in our society.
It's sickeningly sweet. And I think that's also another thing that we can possibly tie to the media and to the news outlets is that they usually spin stories in a way that garners a large audience, but at the expense of factual accuracy.
Well, I mean, and on the back of the box here, just for the audience, it says it has hints of juicy red fruits, and the style is extremely soft and mellow and is perfect when served slightly cool. Great for parties.
Well, I think this label itself is completely false because there's nothing subtle about the hints of red fruit, and it's not even hints, it's absolute exclamation marks.
It's quite the literary analogy there. Impressive.
Indeed.
Well, like you said, it's extremely sweet, almost sickening.
Mm.
Just like corporate media's reporting on the climate change is equally problematic and sickening.
Indeed. And now that we've voiced our disappointment in the wine, it might be worth expanding on why we're also disappointed in the majority of the media from which information can be procured nowadays. Because the truth is that an elite minority actually has a stranglehold over most major media outlets. And actually, these are the elites that benefit the most from deregulated capitalism. So they're the elites that will be the least likely to want news of climate change to be shared, to become mainstream knowledge, and to spurn the types of changes that'll damage their abilities to make profits.
Because they know that if we adequately address the climate crisis, then that's going to lead to radical reorientation in society that will undermine the source of their wealth.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, corporate media is at such a monopoly at this point that in the UK, I'm just going to get my statistics up here to be 100% accurate, that 90% of the newspaper is owned by just three companies. So 90% of the media in this country is owned by three companies, which is just
incredible.
I mean, that is a tiny minority is concentrated so much wealth. And they obviously have power as well over how they report on really salient issues. And if you just draw this connection that, you know, everyday people are consuming this news, and still, even though social media is perhaps offering some disruption, but still much of the same monopolistic status quo, the majority of people still consume their news from conventional media sources that are owned by these corporations. So, you know, there's always this discussion as well, like, how do we engender climate action? And you say, oh, if we present people with the facts, whether that be optimistic or if it's more, you know, presenting it in a very grave reality, then they should be engendered into action. But not only is it not reported on, but it's reported on in such a way that, you know, you leave this TV segment with being even more skeptical. Because what oftentimes happens, for example, and I think hopefully we're moving away from this, is like when people discuss climate change, especially on cable television, it's like you have a scientist saying, well, the climate is changing due to human caused activities. And then a climate denier is like, well, no, this isn't happening. And I've seen that in the US quite a bit, which completely...
They frame it as a debate.
They frame it as a debate, and it completely...
As if there's two valid sides to it.
Exactly. And it completely misconstrues the scientific consensus on climate change. So, I mean, hopefully that has been changing, because I think that the war on climate denial has largely been won. Denial is shifting in new forms, but most people now accept the basis of climate science. So, I mean, that's kind of anecdotal, but I remember growing up and just seeing the way it's framed. So even in those rare instances that they do report on it, it's not in an accurate manner, and it only continues to feed societal delay.
Right. And I think it's even worth considering the types of newspapers or the types of categories that climate change is placed into, because it's definitely limited to a certain type of discourse that's not sort of mainstream categories, but is relegated to like the science and technology chapter at the end of the newspaper, which gets less coverage and less attention from regular readers. So I think the fact that climate change is sort of pigeonholed as this rather niche subject matter kind of completely doesn't reflect the fact that it spills over into every other form of life and every other category as well. So I guess it's a valid question of which parts of newspapers, which sections ought to have priority over covering these relevant topics, or whether each of them ought to tackle it in their own ways.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point, because climate change, as we all know, is not only a scientific issue. It's not only an ecological issue. It's also a political issue. It's an economic issue. It's a cultural issue.
Yeah.
So it needs to bleed into all of these different bylines on a newspaper. It should not be consigned, as you said, into the science category. Yeah. And there's an organization called Climate Silence. And not only they're saying, well, the media needs to report on it more, but they need to do it in a much more realistic, progressive manner, and say all of these, you know, concentric crises that we're seeing in our society, whether that be coronavirus or the economic response to coronavirus, all of these are climate issues. Climate change is not only a policy on a docket of other issues. You know, it is the umbrella issue under which all other issues fall. Because climate change, in the end, is the great unifier, in the sense that we all share the same planet.
Right. And, we all, even if we won't equally suffer the consequences of a climate that's completely set off track by climate change, it will still impact the globe as a whole in various different ways. So it's the great unifying that the consequences will also reverberate across the globe too.
And I think we're obviously delving already into how it's being reported, but we can also look back as to why is it not being reported as much in the first place. And we mentioned in the UK, for example, that three companies own 90% of the news media. And half of that is owned by Rupert Murdoch, who some of us may know as the henchman or the leader of Fox News, which has been unique in proliferating right-wing media and fake news. So Rupert Murdoch has been, you know, very well known to be a climate skeptic. And, you know, the fact that he owns half of the media in the UK suggests that he has carved out, again, a unique role in stifling that news coverage. So we are going to take a short music break here, and we're going to delve into more of the issues around for-profit journalism and why the corporate model is fundamentally inept or incapable of adequately covering the climate crisis. So we'll see you in a bit.
Thank you, Bruno Mars, for that exceptional cover of Valerie. Really a beautiful tribute to quite an incredible songwriter, singer-songwriter.
Yes.
And now we're back. And I think what we'll start with is to talk about the way the media frames certain issues. So I think it's not just a case of not reporting on important issues related to climate change. It's also the type of language they use, the type of angle they take, and the failure often to make the link explicit between certain events and often the sort of climate change or global warming issues that underlie them. So I think one of the main examples that we've seen quite frequently over the last few years, sadly, is the link between global warming and extreme weather events.
Yeah.
So most recently, we saw that in the US with the gigantic winter storms.
So, as we all know, or some of us know, there were severe winter storms in the US. So what some climate scientists have suggested is that the polar vortex encroached more southwards than usual because of a weakened jet stream, which is a direct impact of climate change. So we had these bitterly cold weather complexes moving towards the southern United States, which is oftentimes known for warm, balmy weather. And so what happened is, you know, in Texas or in other places in the southern United States, when they started experiencing these bitter cold temperatures, the first thing that many households did was crank up their heat, right? But you have all of these households cranking up their heat using a lot of electricity, which caused the whole grid to crash because they never expected such extreme weather to result in all of these households using so much energy. And by the way, this is a grid that has been systematically deregulated and is not fortified, nor is it resilient to face any climate-induced extreme weather. So the grid collapsed, including natural gas plants, by the way, even though a lot of right-wing politicians jumped at the idea of, oh, look, this is what happens when you commit to renewable energies, that the grid crashes, even though that is not true and that was fake news, actually. So the grid crashed. Millions of people lost access to electricity as well as running water. So this is like, I mean, we're talking about the wealthiest country in the world and millions of people are without basic necessities for their life. So running water, electricity. I mean, people are literally told to boil water in their own home as a source of heat and a source to clean their water. So this is like, I mean, really stark and drastic. And this is a direct linked to climate change. It is a direct manifestation of the climate emergency.
Yeah, of course. We often are told that the issue with climate change is that it's so abstract and that we don't feel its direct impacts, and that's why people struggle to wrap their heads around it or to feel like they're directly impacted by it. But I think, sorry to interrupt you, Noah, but I just wanted to draw the attention to the point that the impacts are felt. It's just a way of making it clear to the people who've experienced those impacts that what they're experiencing is the early consequences of global warming.
Yeah. So again, it was just a really stark image to see such a wealthy country, the wealthiest country on earth, brought to its knees by an extreme weather event that they were completely unprepared for. And it, again, like we said, this is a direct link to a warming atmosphere. But the media did not report it like that. You know, they said millions of people without water and electricity in Texas or in other southern states. What they should be saying is climate emergency is here, right? They need to directly link these types of events to the climate crisis. Because that will really shock people into thinking, wow, this is, I mean, this is a grave danger. Yeah. I mean, and also kind of shakes people out of the notion that, well, I'm going to be insulated.
Exactly.
It's just going to be a phenomenon that will rip through the global south, and it won't impact me because I'm like a middle-class American and this is not really an issue. But I mean, as we all have seen in plain language and plain eyesight, is that this is, I mean, this is a huge issue which we're radically unprepared for.
Yeah. And I think if that link were made, it would make the people who've experienced, because I think there's a difference between knowing that climate change is an issue in theory and experiencing it and believing in it, having experienced the hardship that it can cause. So I think if you've gone through something traumatic, I wouldn't say that for most people it was traumatic, but it definitely inconvenienced a lot of people, and for some it was extremely serious.
I mean, some people died.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a young boy who died of freezing to death.
Yeah.
In the wealthiest country on earth. I mean, it's just a complete failure. It suggests that the U.S. is a failed state in many respects, not to mention the litany of other issues that impact that country, whether it be out of control gun violence, etc. But that's a bit tangential. It just, I mean, I think it was less of an inconvenience. Like, you have to imagine being in your home, all of a sudden there's no electricity, and we had that for one night, or briefly in the morning, and it was a real inconvenience. I mean, it was inconvenience, but the longer you have that, and we still had running water, we still had heat.
We actually had a leak in our bathroom, which was rather terrifying.
That was an inconvenience. But then you imagine your house is cold. You don't have running water. You have no electricity. So you're literally living like a subsistence lifestyle almost. Like you're being
stripped of all the comforts that you've gotten used to.
The carbon rich comforts.
Yeah.
Of course, that brought this crisis to your doorstep.
Yeah.
And I thought about this a bit, is if the initial signs of warming are so in our face that we can't ignore them, but before it's too late. So we still have 10 years left to limit warming to 1.5 degrees, which the UN emissions gap report suggests would take 7% emission cuts per year for the next 10 years. So it's not too late, but we are seeing these really dire impacts already. Yeah. So my hope is almost, even though there will be suffering involved, and that is horrendous, but that these initial impacts will shake people out of their denial and their ignorance, their complacency. And the media, again, has to play a huge role in this.
Right. And I think, so we've talked about framing, and I think that can be broadened out beyond that one example of these winter storms to many other natural, completely non-natural, human-caused natural disasters, such as the heat waves and fires in Australia, or the forest fires in the Amazon, or various hurricanes that are ripped through North America at an unprecedented frequency. But I think beyond framing, another issue that we have to talk about is the amount of time climate change gets, the amount of coverage it gets, just in terms of minutes on air. So I've got a little anecdote for this. I was on a pilgrimage with my siblings in the south of France, and there was a TV on in the corner, and it was showing the daily news, and they showed extremely brief footage of the crazy forest fires that were happening in the Amazon basin at this time, but maybe covered it in about 5 seconds, and then they spent about maybe 5 minutes on a story of a woman who'd failed to wear a mask on a train, on a public train in France, and had to be arrested by the local police. So I think that really underlined to me the fundamental disjuncture between the seriousness of certain issues and the limited coverage that it gets.
Yeah, and which brings up a larger issue about the media is the profit model for corporate media oftentimes is clickbait. It's portraying these extremely bizarre or antagonizing events that kind of sow the seeds of social fracture. You see things that are so, like, what's happening here? So out of bounds that you click on it, you see an advertisement, that media company makes money, the advertiser probably sells you their product, cowboys and keys propagating.
Yeah.
But it is that whole idea about we're just feeding people this bile, if you will, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whatsoever. It's just like about fueling spectacle without actually educating people. And right, we live in a democracy. At least we think we live in a democracy. And democracy, in my mind, is fundamentally a commitment to truth. So when the truth starts becoming inflated, it starts becoming more, you know, everyone has their own opinion of what the truth is. We don't have a solid foundation to fall back on.
Yeah.
That, of course, silos people into their own echo chambers. And we have no means of connecting with one another. So, I mean, of course, we now know fake news is a massive issue. Most recently, seeing how it unplays in the United States with, I mean, the insurrection on the Capitol, the literal nucleus of American democracy, which is whipped up by a president who just spread lies throughout his presidency, thousands of lies. So, I mean, I think not reporting on climate change certainly factors into that larger issue. So just the for-profit journalism industry is not built to actually report on meaningful issues that educate the voter. Because right. In the end, we all participate and should participate in our civic duty of voting and electing people who care about important things.
Yeah. So, yeah, I wonder what it is about climate change that makes it a topic that's unsuited to this sort of profit-seeking model of journalism. I guess maybe it's not appealing enough to the majority of people. They wouldn't be tempted to click on the types of headlines that announce news related to climate change. Perhaps that has to... Is that likely to change? Or does the model of journalism have to change? Does it have to go from one that's fueled by completely profit-based motivations to something that's slightly more regulated and that runs on the objective to educate the population and to communicate facts without twisting them, embellishing them, seeking to turn them into an attractive and provocative story.
Right. And I think we also need to talk about the new social media, the new types of ways of reporting, and, you know, whether that be Facebook,
Twitter,
Instagram, Twitter, because that's mostly what young people consume. I mean, also actually entirely across the spectrum of the population. I mean, I think more and more old people, for example, there's this interesting stratification where kind of our parents' generation tends to stick to Facebook, and we have our own means of communication and news consumption that tends to be more in like Instagram and TikTok.
Well, Instagram, I think our generation, and then the up and coming.
Yeah, well, youth. Even more of a acute application. So, but then again, social media. We would talk about big tech, and we see similar parallels between corporate media being a monopoly. I mean, social media companies are a massive monopoly, indeed. And they, of course, make most of their money as well from journalism. It's basically like a Middle Eastern economy, and their relation to oil is the relationship for between
advertisement, you mean, or journalism?
The relationship between journalism and advertisements is the same as a Middle Eastern economy and the relationship to oil.
Yeah.
Because they're so dependent on it.
Yeah.
And again, there are so many vested interests in the way they report news and how fake news has become like totally out of control. Totally out of control. I think it's almost better to view social media's as a media company rather than something else, because at the end of the day, they are a source of information for people.
Yeah.
And I think Facebook has attempted to get this fake news plague under control. But for example, when it comes to the climate issue, there have been reports that one of the vetted Facebook climate checkers, the fact checkers, are actually include organizations that have been linked to climate denial. So, I mean, and the other issue is, say you put out an egregious article that says, oh, climate science is fake, we shouldn't worry about this, which would go against Facebook's, you know, putative guidelines. But once it's up for like, what, 10 minutes before they get to take it down, and it's already been seen by millions of people.
That's, so the damage that's enough time done. To be reshared, to be... I think one of the issues with controlling this type of news is the speed at which it propagates and the speed at which it creates new news. So often these types of news piggyback on each other. So they don't actually go back to the source of the facts. They re-report using the facts produced by another news report, just for the sake of efficiency and for getting the story out as quickly as possible. So there's a real issue there with a lack of time taken to double check the facts before news is exposed to the public. And I think that's one of the main routes in which avenues through which mistakes can seep in.
Yeah.
But I mean, mistakes is one thing, and then deliberate misleading of the public is another.
Absolutely. So folks, we're going to take another music break here. We'll be right back. And after the break, we're going to be discussing alternative ways of framing the climate crisis. So perhaps, like we suggested, moving away from the for-profit journalism model to more creative, artistic representations of the climate crisis. Welcome back, folks. I hope you enjoyed that nice music break by Queen. So before we went to the music break, we discussed a bit about artistic, creative, alternative ways about combating the climate crisis. So I think this is really important because, you know, facts and empirical studies are one thing, but it's a completely other thing to actually inspire the moral imagination of a public. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes we fail to actually grasp what 1.5 degrees means, what 2 degrees, what 3 degrees means. So art, and especially creative literary engagements with the climate crisis, can certainly help with people to not only envision what an unmitigated planetary emergency looks like, but also what a hopeful post-capitalist society looks like that has addressed the climate crisis. So one thing we have come up with, I am currently still the editor-in-chief of Unearth Magazine, which is a student publication dedicated to covering the climate crisis and offering radical solutions. In conversation with Timo, we've identified a potential gap that we should fill, and that's exactly what I just discussed. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pass it over to Timo maybe to maybe introduce the initiative that we have come up with.
Yeah, so as Noah was saying, we thought it would be really worthwhile for the magazine to broaden out the types of submissions it accepts because, as Noah has very nicely introduced, academic and argumentative approaches based on facts and empirical studies are really useful and really valuable. But another really valuable approach is to try to broaden people's imaginations by encouraging a creative engagement with these serious issues related to climate change, and to see how people can try to reimagine society and sort of engage with the problems that they see and try to bring their own personal twists to these issues. So I think it might be worth just reading out this little thing, this little introduction that we have for this section of storytelling. It might inspire our listeners currently to let their creative juices flow and to maybe concoct something and submit it for publication. So here we go. Climate change is the defining challenge of our generation. There is no silver bullet solution to the myriad threats it poses, no single approach that will shed clarity on its complexities, no comprehensive answer to the clamoring questions it poses. These questions about who we are, both as individuals and as a species, in relation to the concentric circles of family, community, nation, planet, can seem overwhelming. Where are we coming from and where are we headed? How do we go about changing everything about the way we live, eat, move, socialize, see the world? How do we turn knowledge into belief and belief into action? How do we extricate ourselves from a system that values profit over life? What tools can we use to puncture the myth of infinite growth and replace it with humility? Every question births another. Luckily, no single mind has to come up with answers to all of them. For the past few years, Unearth Magazine's incredible team of writers and editors has been at the forefront of the St. Andrew student body's efforts to tackle these topics. The magazine is now looking to broaden its scope beyond the analytical language of its prior publications. Under the heading of storytelling, the magazine is looking to publish creative literary engagements with the climate crisis. These can range from poems to short stories, descriptive passages and thought pieces. The possibilities are endless. In terms of content,
The possibilities are equally broad, though we would like to encourage our applicants to find hope, whenever possible, in their pieces. It is not Unearth's intention to publish a dispiriting portfolio of grim, apocalyptic scenarios. It is by telling stories that we can engage our hearts as well as our minds. It is by evoking what is under threat, what is on the line, and what has already been lost that we will finally snap out of our collective apathy. And it is by sketching out promising alternatives that the world will lose its sheen of inevitability. The first step towards changing society is reimagining it. Writers, get to work.
There we go.
That was fantastic.
That's the little pep talk. So we've got 7 listeners currently, so hopefully we'll get 7 publications by tomorrow morning.
Yes, so storytelling is the name of the new initiative, as Timo outlined, and it's essentially for any student out there or any person in general who wants to write about the climate crisis in more of a creative way. So that includes short stories, poems, just general creative engagements. Let your imagination run free. We'd be willing to accept anything. And yeah, we would really love to publish all of your stories. So again, the deadline to submit a piece is April 21st, and you can find out more information on the Unearth magazine website. So
yeah, I think for this final section of the episode, it might be useful to talk about why there haven't been that many literary creative engagements with climate change. So what are the current obstacles that have prevented this huge issue from being tackled by novelists over the past few decades? And actually, Amitav Ghosh, who's a famous scholar and author, actually, wrote The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable, in which this is one of the foundational questions. So what makes climate change unimaginable and unrepresentational? Shouldn't That's not a word, is it? In
unrepresentative.
Unrepresentable.
That's not a word.
No.
Is it?
Unrepresentable.
All right.
in literature. So he points out a couple of things. One of the issues that he points out is that settings in works of fiction are often limited to very specific locales, because it's impossible to create a sense of rich setting and of a rich sense of place if you go too broad, or if you try to expand beyond a graspable space. And that's one of the issues, obviously, with an issue that's very global and that transcends borders and limitations. On the other hand, I think that issue can be overcome quite easily by focusing on the very real local impacts of climate change, because even though it's a global issue, it has very specific manifestations in various local contexts. Obviously, then the challenge is to try to link up those different local issues and try to turn it into a broader global picture.
No, I think that's a very good point, is how do we somehow build on this local foundation and exemplify the climate crisis in very intimate literary ways? Because if we see, you know, a protagonist in a novel experiencing climate change, then that might help us envision what it's going to be like if we don't act now. Right? I mean, depending if this is a dystopian novel or what type of genre, what type of route it's taking. But in general, if we just represent the climate crisis in all of its complexity, in all of its kind of all-encompassing character, that would be very good, I think.
Yeah. And another point, actually, that Ghosh makes, which is a slightly more convoluted, is that the modern novel actually moves away from unusual events and starts focusing more specifically on turning the everyday into the centerpiece of the novel.
Yeah.
So that's one of the defining features of the modern novel, is its inclusion of vivid detail to transform the everyday into the exceptional. On the other hand, what Ghosh argues is that climate change is a hugely exceptional, unusual, and he uses the term uncanny phenomenon, which would force a reevaluation of modern methods of novel writing to bring the exceptional back into the center.
Sure. And yeah, I think that whole exceptional piece is really fundamental, because oftentimes in novels, nature just plays a background role. It's just like context. It's almost seen as passive. It has no agency.
Yeah.
When we know, we're seeing right now that nature is making, I mean, if you want to call it a comeback, I mean, nature is a dynamic, connected, ever-fluid force that is present in our lives. And it is certainly a product of modernity that we view nature as, I mean, if you want to describe Mother Nature, you think about what that means, a very nice
nurturing,
nurturing. But we all know that if you
poke the bear,
it's going to come back to get you. But just to bring it back to the novel, I think it's important to not treat nature as context, but as something that is constantly intertwined throughout the plot and plays more of a fundamental role, because we need to break down that fiction of nature society division.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's true that often the temptation is to relegate nature to a background role, or to have its only function being something that human characters have an impact on or interact with, and that's the only thing that gives them meaning. Whereas I think the truth is that it's much more of a two-way exchange, where nature can have as much of a direct impact on human characters and protagonists as the other way around.
Yeah.
Not just in novels, but obviously in life as well. And trying to reflect that in literature is a huge challenge, because obviously the literary tradition focuses almost completely, at least in the modern era, on human characters and protagonists.
Right.
So it's a huge challenge to try to reframe that and to how do you make nature as an abstract entity, central character, without anthropomorphizing it.
Without anthropomorphizing it either, because you don't want to give it human qualities.
Human characteristics.
That's the whole point. Because that kind of just masks the anthropocentrism. It puts it in a different spin if you start putting nature in kind of a human characteristic. But another thing with the modern novel is that it tends to focus on the individual rather than the collective.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an issue because, as we all know, climate change is a collective issue, although certainly there have been a select amount of actors in society, whether that be fossil fuel corporations or politicians, that have been abetted by fossil capital. But it's going to take large portions of the population to come together, especially in the global north, who have caused this crisis, to change their carbon-rich consumerism and engender real societal action. But by focusing on the individual, it imbricates or continues to push forward this hyper-individualism that is so common in Western society, and upon which neoliberalism and capitalism thrive, right? This whole image of the individual consumer.
Mm-hmm.
It almost strips away our humanity, right? We're not seen as citizens anymore. We're seen as consumers that consume goods and services, put value into the economy, and it's like this ever-flowing cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow the novel needs to move away from the individualism, and I don't know how. I mean, for anybody who wants to write this for the storytelling initiative, how do we somehow make a collective protagonist? You know,
how to try to take that beyond certain attempts that have already been made to make the collective into the nation, because I think one thing that climate change is going to make rather clear is that national delineations are no longer going to be sufficient to tackle this problem. There's going to have to be a sense of community that goes beyond national political barriers.
I mean,
so how do you make it a collective or a sense of community that isn't political or built on these myths of cultural homogeneity?
Well, I think honestly it just comes back to us all being human, right? I mean, we live in a world with arbitrary nation-state demarcations and oftentimes specious divisions of ethnicities and cultures, but in the end, we're all human, right? And that is a really powerful phenomenon that we lose sight of, that we're the same species, we're the same animal.
Yeah.
So if we somehow, you don't want to continue the anthropocentrism either, though.
As those of you who listened to our last episode, which was about the factory farming and about modern agriculture, we're definitely not saying that humans are the center of everything and we don't owe certain forms of behavior to other species on the planet.
So the collective is not only just humans, but literally life, right? And it's like, if you've heard of the Gaia hypothesis by
James Lovelock,
who thinks the Earth is a superorganism and everyone is interacting with one another,
living, breathing global ecosystem,
biotic, abiotic, human, non-human. So if you have this like radical anthropocentric, agnostic, ecocentric aligned religion, I don't know, it's just like, it needs to be, I think it's amazing, because we have this task and we can use the real creative genius of a lot of these thinkers.
Yeah, but I think that the final few minutes of our discussion has made it quite clear why a lot of authors have turned away from this issue in complete exasperation and helplessness, because it's such a monumental task to try to include the sort of scope that we've been talking about, to bear in mind that we have to look beyond individuals to the communities that they're included in, not just human but also non-human and living, to look beyond very narrow space-bound settings to include more global and far-reaching ones. It's an incredible challenge, and it's really difficult to know where to go with it, but I think it should be seen more as a motivating force to see this kind of huge potential and need for people to engage with literature on this front.
Yeah.
And there's definitely great creative minds out there.
Absolutely.
And I think that the whole concept behind our Unearthed magazine initiative was for people to try bringing little fragments of those stories into the limelight, and they're not going to create an all-encompassing story by themselves, but if they can start bringing little bits of stories, then hopefully those can be woven together into a sort of tapestry that works.
A tapestry of life.
Beautiful.
Because we need a rebellion for life itself.
I think that could be a nice note to end it on.
Absolutely. So thank you everyone again for tuning in for another episode of Save the Planet.
Why not?
We'll see you next week, same time. Thank you everyone, and goodbye.